Yes, this is Bill Hartung. I'm with the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. I'm here with Lee Smith, and we're going to talk about Musharraf, the situation in Pakistan, and related issues.
Hi, I'm Lee Smith, and I'm speaking here from the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., where I'm a visiting fellow and working on a project right now about Arab media. And I look forward to speaking to you, Bill.
Great. Well, one thing I was wanting your input on is you had written a piece a few days ago sort of on the notion that Musharraf has his problems, but he's really our best hope in that part of the world, and we shouldn't be undercutting him even to the degree that perhaps the Bush administration was, you know, as of a week or so ago. And things are moving rapidly, but what's your take now on sort of what the line should be in terms of yeah. U.S. relations with Musharraf, how to proceed, and what's obviously becoming a bit of a crisis?
Yeah, I think there was some stuff I probably didn't articulate very clearly in that piece. I mean, it's awful to see, you know, a lot of people gave me a hard time about it, understandably. It's not a fun thing to see lawyers and judges getting rounded up and arrested, and then, you know, the former Prime Minister Bhutto put under house arrest. It seems that things are moving very quickly. I still maintain, though, that the the U.S. has to, that Washington has to get a pretty clear idea of how it wants to handle its allies in the region. And I think that this was, at least the initial response was a mishandling of Musharraf. Do you agree? What's your sense of it?
Well, I think I did a small piece that was in my blog at TPM Cafe saying basically Musharraf must go. Now, that can't happen today or tomorrow, but I think we should be moving in the direction of what Secretary Rice said. Well, you know, this is really about people of Pakistan. It's not just about General Musharraf. And I think it's obviously a dangerous turning point. You can't just sort of say, you know, we supported you yesterday and today we're saying goodbye. But I think there should be movement towards outreach to other civil society groups. Pressure should be pretty firm towards lifting the emergency as soon as possible, having some sort of elections that are internationally acceptable. So I think a lot of the, discussion probably is about the details of how to proceed. I think you could have rhetoric, as the communist had said, you know, is it time for Musharraf to go? You could say, as you've been saying, well, he's an important ally. We can't have to be careful how we handle it. And it'll really sort of resolve to, well, you know, what are the practical things we might be able to do now? And I have no, monopoly on wisdom about that.
Right. Well, this is curious because, Joe Biden said, I guess it was last week, Senator Biden said, we need a Pakistan policy, not a Musharraf policy. And absolutely, I agree. I'm just curious to know what people mean when they say that. I was reading a piece, I write frequently for the Weekly Standard, and I was reading a piece on Pakistan on the most recent issue. And, you know, it's basically talking about a Pakistan policy that looks a lot like the Middle East policy that this administration has attempted to pursue throughout the region, to not a tremendous amount of success so far. So I guess I would just ask you, do you have any sense of, or do you have an idea for what a Pakistan policy would look like? Or do you have any idea of what, just what that would look like?
Well, I think somehow we have to get past the notion that we're sort of wedded to this dictatorship, this military government. Sort of we've painted ourselves into this corner. We have no other options. After all, they've got nuclear weapons. They're the best sort of force we have to fight terrorism in the region. I think somehow that those assumptions have to be reconsidered. I think now that Musharraf has cracked down again, I think he's losing a lot of support from the sort of middle in Pakistan, which would be essential, I think, to waging any kind of effective fight against terrorism. And somehow I think it's gotten blurred in his rhetoric that, you know, this is about saving the country from the extremists and look what these terrible decisions the Supreme Court has made, and kind of conflating the democracy impulse and the anti-terror impulse in a way that I think is going to, sort of cast a negative light on the legitimate need to fight terrorism in Pakistan, confuse it with his personal quest for survival.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, one of the things that sort of struck me is, I mean, certainly at the extreme reaches of anxiety about Pakistan, there are people who say, well, you know, Bin Laden will come to, effectively Bin Laden will come to power, and Bin Laden will have control of a nuclear arsenal. Now, I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think that is a fairly extreme scenario. But I guess one concern that we probably should have is, do the Democrats, does the center, the people that we've described, and I believe are our natural allies, liberal Democrats in Pakistan, do they have the wherewithal to control a military that right now certainly seems to be complicit in lots of different places with the Taliban, with Al Qaeda, with very dangerous regional elements? So I guess that's my question. Do these Democrats, I mean, Musharraf, I think quite accurate, when people say he's played both sides of the fence, I think that's absolutely correct. But do we think that the Democrats would have any control over the military at all? What's your sense of that?
Yes. Well, so I guess you're saying Musharraf, in a sense, at least he knows the players. And so whatever his vacillations have been.
Unfortunately, yeah, right.
He may be better positioned to control the military or keep it in some semblance of check. Whereas if you have a new player on the block, what kind of relations do they have with the military? How deep is their knowledge? That kind of question. Well, right. I think that's to be determined to some degree. I do think that I was encouraged to see that the administration is trying to reach out to mm-hmm. other parts of Pakistani society and other quietly, not quietly enough that it didn't get in the Washington Post, but quietly to other military
yeah,
leaders
right.
and sort of gauge their positions. Because I think it's certainly conceivable that you could have a democratic or beginnings of democratic transition that the important elements of the military could work with, but I don't know where that stands at the moment. That's why I think whatever's done can't be abrupt. I do know that the nuclear weapons are disassembled. They're in multiple sites around the country. It wouldn't be possible for somebody to just
go in and grab
a usable nuke and get out. But on the other hand, as you say, there's kind of interpenetrations between the extremists and the intelligence services and the military. And so depending, who decided to help extremist elements, there certainly could be some dangerous, developments out of this. So I guess the question would be, is Musharraf losing his grip in any case, whatever knowledge his special agents
right.
is? And if he is, how do you bridge that gap, which I think is, maybe one of the biggest questions
right.
we have to deal with. Because whatever you think, on the merits or in ideally about democracy and human rights, obviously you don't want the place to blow up because you've moved abruptly in the name
right.
of one of those things rhetorically without looking at those consequences on the very serious security side.
Right. If I can just ask something else, have you did you see this piece in the LA Times about Imran Khan, or have you been following Imran Khan closely at all? Or
his popularity among the students.
Yeah, right. I mean, it made him, I'm just laughing because it made him sound like a real, make him sound like a real youth leader, and maybe he is. But this guy seems to be a huge headache for lots of different people. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but he just seems to be a problem, an interesting and charismatic character. But he seems to be a real big problem. What's your sense of the guy?
Well, I don't know a huge amount about him, but he doesn't seem like somebody who's ready to grab the helm of Pakistan, certainly.
Right.
Like, would you want Bono to run the UN? I mean, this is probably more serious.
Yeah, well, yes, I would.
Serious
actually.
To run the UN.
That'd be great.
But I think that's the challenge is if you have a democratic movement and it's kind of beginning to grow, and now you've got the student component,
right.
you've got the lawyers, you've got these established parties which have been compromised in their own ways over the years. How do you steer through that in a way that's ideally more democratic and still stable enough to get through this whole series of difficult problems that are faced there? But I guess my bottom line is still, my fear is that Musharraf is going to go regardless, and the question is, can the United States have any positive influence on how that goes about, as opposed to just being perceived as backing him to the hilt to the last moment,
right.
which may be already passed the pale, given that the administration has been saying some of the right things about stopping the emergency and other alternatives and such. But it's sort of, the policy's been there for quite a while, so the question is, at this point, can you do anything significant that will have an impact, or are you sort of stuck with your past choices in a way?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think that is a very interesting question. What kind of effect, you know, I mean, what kind of effect can the administration, you know, can the administration have right now on who's, there was a piece in the Post yesterday, which you, I mean, I know that you write a lot about nuclear strategic issues. Did you see this piece in the Post about how, you know, how Musharraf is, I mean, almost basically booby-trapped the regime with the nuclear program? That and I mean this is kind of an interesting problem for us, isn't it? Who are the other choices besides Musharraf? But you know, what does that mean for the, you know, what does that mean about their nuclear arsenal?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, it, more so than has been talked about, he's been significant part of the problem in the sense that he's been kind of almost a bodyguard for the AQ Khan network.
Right. They were, right. That is an enormous deal.
I mean, they were supplying material to North Korea, to Iran, pretty much to, you know, they were the only non-axis of evil designated country supplying all the members thereof with nuclear technology, and as well as beyond. And basically, he's
sort of... Is Khan just being sort of held under loose house arrest or something like that? Or what is the situation with that?
He's in one of his estates, and he's supposed to be electronically monitored, but any relations, discussions between him and U.S. officials have to be through the Pakistani government, and they're kind of strict about when and how he can be talked to and so forth. So it's kind of akin to me to the issue with Musharraf and the extremists, where he's kind of put himself in this position where, well, no, he hasn't solved the problem for us, but it could get worse, you know, and so it is a very difficult sort of juncture that we're at. But I do think that the more we invest in him, the less we're going to get in return.
Right.
I really do think there's got to be a break that says, well, you know, we can envision a different relationship with Pakistan where there is opening for modern democratic government that's got decent relations with the military, where they, of course, will be our ally in the war on terror, but they'll decide how far they're willing to risk that, where we'd like to see ideally better cooperation in dealing with nonproliferation, but all this would have to be basically set up on a new basis as a new sort of governmental setup emerges. So it's a fine line between, you know, well, we've got this leverage, we're giving them $10 billion in aid, can't we just sort of twist their arms and, you know, not really. I mean, it's limited. But, you know, what within that, what political kind of position do we want to take, and how do we want to at least try to shape the outcome of something that may be very different next week than what we're talking about today.
I mean, it's kind of an interesting problem around the region, isn't it? I mean, I've spent a fair amount of time in Egypt, and it always strikes me that this is what the Mubarak regime has done. You know, but a lot of different places in the Middle East have done the same different thing. They've sort of put themselves in between the United States and the extremist element. I mean, Musharraf has the advantage also of having a nuclear program he's put himself in front of. But, yeah, what are the different... I mean, Pakistan could actually serve as sort of an interesting test case if there is a larger, larger civil society there, then there should be something to work with, as there may not be in different parts of the Arab world, for instance. So Pakistan should be... Yeah, it should be a way for people to be able to think about this. How do you get around the regimes? Who are the other people that you can talk to? And I'm not so sure that we're doing such a great job of this, meaning Washington. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I think they're coming to it very late in the day. And I think even sort of the modest shift that Secretary of State Rice has made is getting some resistance from within the administration. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that, you know, you've got... strong interest in having an independent judiciary. You've got lawyers willing to, you know, essentially risk their careers on the notion that there shouldn't be real rule of law there. It's an interesting movement. It's not just, thankfully, the extremists versus Musharraf, which in a lot of other countries, that middle group is so weakened that they don't really have a voice. You have to contemplate, well, how would you rebuild that kind of secular middle to have... any kind of hopeful democratic path. And so I think... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, on the other hand, I mean, one of the things that we see in Pakistan is that the extremists, I mean, these guys, this is, you know, these guys are ties to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. I mean, you know, and in other, I mean, Saudi Arabia is definitely a huge issue, and Egypt is an issue, not as big as Saudi Arabia. But these are like, these are like real bad guys, these extremists. You know what I mean? It's not just sort of a, it's not just sort of a threatening, scary, shadowy group. I mean, these are the real, this is the real thing.
Right. I mean, you've got a sense of what you're getting. It's not just, gee, we're not, you're not happy with their rhetoric on this or that.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, I would like to see somehow the Bush folks basically take some of that rhetoric of Secretary of State Rice and put some mm-hmm. flesh on it. That, that if it's uh-huh. about the future of Pakistan, it's not just about Musharraf or Benazir Bhutto, then there should be certain kind of standards of conduct we're expecting from uh-huh. the Pakistani government. And we're not assuming one way or the other whether Musharraf can reach them, but we're encouraging right. him to do so. And then, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, over the next few months, we can see whether that has an effect. I mean, it, mm-hmm. He hasn't really yielded anything yet by saying, oh, I'll have elections, but I'm not going to get rid of the state of emergency.
Right.
Because you can't have elections under those conditions. But if he could be moved in that direction, I think part of the question is, well, what's in it for him? I mean,
mm-hmm. right.
you know, how is he going to navigate through this process in a way that he's got any incentive to open up the system to the extent where he may be voted out of power?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, at a minimum, there's got to be some sort of discussions among the parties there that, you know, he's not going to be, you know, put up there as a war criminal. He's not going to suffer
repercussions. Yeah, right.
He's going to...
He's not going to wind up where Benazir Bhutto's father did. Right.
That would be sort of a minimum bottom line, I would think.
Right.
And then the question is, well, you know, how he would function politically, and were he not to win, he could still be a player and so forth.
Right.
Could there be a development where the, you know, the new government, whatever it might be, we continue to open the system, not just say, oh, great, we've got power now. Now we're going to use it against
right.
our former enemies. Whatever the, you know, differences may be of the types of offenses that you're talking about, there's got to be some sort of
right.
opening where some of that is put in the past, where it's not sort of just, you know, grist for political vengeance fights, which
right.
I think would quickly get us back to the situation that we're
right.
In now.
Well, here's something that I'm not at all clear about. I'm not certain who's running. I mean, you know, we talked about before that the U.S. doesn't have a Pakistan policy; it has a Musharraf policy. I'm not even sure who's running the U.S.'s Musharraf policy, and I don't say that entirely facetiously, because it seems that the Secretary of State, while she's had different things to say about this, and some of these things I disagree with, it seems that her attention is elsewhere. Well, her attention is definitely elsewhere. Her attention is on the, you know, on the peace process, on getting people to show up at the Annapolis conference. So I guess my question is, who is going to do the work that needs to be done right now with Pakistan? Has she sort of, you know, I mean, I don't even know the actual person that she's fielded this out to. I mean, we know that Iran is basically run by Burns now, and Welch is doing Lebanon and Syria and Egypt. But who is in charge of Pakistan? And why is Secretary Rice not stepping forward even more aggressively on this?
Well, it seems to me, if we're going to have it, you know, make any difference, she's got to take the lead. And even if that
right.
means lowering expectations for the Annapolis meeting, or somehow, right. it's sort of, you know, this crisis is today, and the,
right.
the Middle East peace process is ongoing, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
And so I think somehow she needs to make a shift, or else identify a very visible deputy, or even an envoy, someone
right.
who makes it clear that this is not just kind of a PR issue for the United States, but it's
right.
a serious reconsideration of policy. And
right.
I haven't seen that they've done that. That would be something to
right.
keep an eye on, because, you know, otherwise, I think you're right. She's got a lot of, I mean, there's still that little war going on in Iraq, and there's still
right.
the question of
which also she seems to have nothing. Which also she seems to have nothing to do with. I mean, it's really. I mean, I hate to sort of change direction so quickly, but it's really kind of astonishing. Yes, we have the war in Iraq, we have this. You know, we have this huge issue with Pakistan, and Secretary Rice is worried about Annapolis. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just astonishing. And this is one of the points that I I made in this article last week. I just think that the way that she's looking at Pakistan and the way that she's looking at the Israeli-Palestinian issue, there's just something out of whack here. There's just something that doesn't make sense.
And you think the priorities should be reversed, or there's not really much to be gained at this point in the Annapolis process, so that she should really be pulling back substantially from that, or how do you?
I think so too. I think she's throwing a lot at that. I think that Pakistan is an enormous issue, but it really she seems to have detached herself from Iraq as well. And maybe that's understandable. Certainly a lot of other people have done that in different ways, but she is also the Secretary of State. And to be going back and forth and spending this much time on the peace process at this moment just makes no sense. It's hard to explain it in any other way outside from her own personal vanity to have a legacy someday of her own which is going to involve the peace process. And while everything else is burning in this incredibly strategically important region, she's paying attention to the Israelis and the Palestinians. I really don't get it.
Well, I think it's a critical issue. I think the part of the problem is, I was opposed to going into Iraq in the first place, which really doesn't matter at this point. Doesn't resolve what you do next, really, whether you're for or against it. But it seems to me that the administration is paying the price for the amount of resources they've had to pour into Iraq. They misperceived what they thought would be involved, both, I think, militarily, economically, in terms of alliances, in terms of leverage in other parts of the world. And so I think part of the argument is, well, we need to look at the bigger framework of the Middle East, and one element of that is peace between Israel and the Palestinians, which is, I think it's beyond unfortunate that they're turning it so late in their two terms, because it's not clear how much they can really accomplish. But I do think it would be useful for there to be at least some movement in the right direction that a new administration can pick up on. The question is, how much of the personal energy of the Secretary of State does that take? Who else does she have who can deal with Pakistan? I mean, I think she should be able to juggle a few high-profile issues at once, especially if she's not centrally involved in policy in Iraq. And a lot of it has seemed to be the question of, well, when does she have the authority to really take action as opposed to just do a holding action on a lot of these things? And I still am not entirely clear on that. I think in the case of North Korea, the State Department was able to really allow it to negotiate, carry the ball. I view that as having some positive potential, whereas in a Middle East peace discussion, it's not clear to me how serious the administration is about doing something beyond saying, see, we haven't forgotten about you. We're focused.
I think they're really serious about it insofar as they seem to have given Secretary Rice as much room as she wants on it. I mean, I think that, I know that a lot of people don't believe this, but I actually think that this president, I don't know about everyone in the administration, but I actually think that this president has been pretty serious about, has been serious about a Palestinian state for a long time. And has certainly been hopeful and optimistic about the peace process. I'm not sure I entirely agree, but I also think that they're giving Secretary Rice a lot of room to do this, and they're letting her spend an awful lot of energy and prestige on it. And so what's going on in the meantime in Iraq and Pakistan? Yeah, actually, I want to ask you a question about Iran.
Sure.
What does Pakistan say now? What is happening in Pakistan say? What does this say about the Iranian nuclear program? I mean, if one of the things that we're concerned about is that Musharraf has managed to, in some ways, insulate himself or protect himself with his live nuclear program, what does it say about the Iranian, the nascent nuclear program? What kind of problems will that present that we are only starting to see now, or do you think these are two entirely separate cases? What's your sense of should our thinking on Iran change at all? Should it get harder? Should it get how should we respond?
Well, I think the one thing I see as a result of the current crisis in Pakistan is kind of obvious point, but it's much harder to deal with a regime that's got nuclear weapons.
I mean, right.
To put pressure on them, to leverage them. Suddenly you've got this whole other if not world-ending, at least region-destroying element.
So should this make us be harder with the Iranians now, you think?
Well, I think people will be able to argue both ways. I mean, I would argue that if we could show some firmness with Musharraf, if we could move towards a democratic transition, if we could push for eventually reductions and certainly better controls over their nuclear weapons, I think it would strengthen our hand in trying to hold off Iran from getting weapons. On the other hand, people might say, well, it's such a headache once a country like this has it. Forget about what's consistent. We just got to stop these folks from getting it, because once they've got it, you get into this kind of very difficult security diplomacy situation. So I think it'll be seized by, you know, for arguments on sort of both sides of the question.
Yeah, right.
Should we be tough with Iran? Should we negotiate? I already feel like we've got more room to negotiate than this administration has been willing to pursue. So I sort of see it more in those terms that, you know, how can we on the one hand say, you know, this guy who happens to have nukes is too important to criticize, and on the other hand, these folks who are just learning how to enrich small amounts of uranium are beyond the pale, even though they might not be able to get these things before, you know, another 10 years, or they might be in an entirely different political situation. So, I do see that, but it's, you know, it's probably almost a rhetorical point compared to the question of what to do now in Pakistan, which
is
sort of the main.
It's not funny. I was going to say it's funny, but yeah, I mean, we've been concerned about Iraq, obviously. We've been concerned about the Iranian program, and then all of a sudden, this problem comes up in Pakistan. It's like, wow, we really had a luxury to be able to worry about Iran and what that what the Iranian project for the Middle East means, and what their proposed nuclear program means for the Middle East. Now we have to deal with something that is right there and is happening, and is happening right now.
It sort of gives pause to one of the arguments that has been implicit in some of the Bush nuclear policy, which is that, well, some countries are just not responsible enough to have nuclear weapons, and others, our allies, we're not thrilled, but we can live with it. But of course, some of our allies are not the most stable countries in the world. And so we don't know who's going to end up with those weapons. And so I think that, you know, going back, you know, probably to the 80s, so this Republican and Democratic administrations implicated, but there was always this notion of, well, yes, Pakistan may be developing nuclear weapons, but we need their help in Afghanistan. We need their help in that part of the world.
Right.
And we can't really sacrifice that, even if it means giving them a little bit of leeway on the nuclear program. And so now here we are. And they've got, 30 to 50 nuclear weapons. India has as many or more. They're still fighting over Kashmir.
Right.
They're in a very volatile region where you've got extremists, within country and so forth. So, over the longer term, had we been a little less sort of sympathetic to that argument that, it's nuclear weapons may be developed, but it's, we can live with it because it's our ally, and say, these things are so dangerous and regimes are so uncertain that, we can't really allow this to happen. Maybe we could have headed off this sort of thing.
Right.
Maybe not. I mean, you don't have perfect control over these things, certainly. But we certainly could have done a lot better than letting AQ Khan run around for years and years, and then even sort of accepting this kind of limited sort of crackdown that they put on his network.
This is interesting. Do you know what the Indians are thinking about this now? In particular, since the Indians were sort of not part of the end. I mean, the U.S. gave them a big break on their nuclear program. Do you know if the Indians are now saying, it's great if we did not have a nuclear program, and with this instability in Pakistan, we'd be in real trouble. And now they feel, they can breathe a little easier, or what's your sense of that? I mean, I know it's kind of a weird question what the Indians are thinking, but
I haven't seen much on that. I mean, their argument has been, we're the responsible ones. I don't know why you let the Pakistanis get this. We certainly are responsible, and thank goodness we have them because we can have deterrence, and we're perfectly capable of understanding deterrence just as you are.
It's those guys who can.
You don't have to give us a little school book to explain it to us.
Right.
But then, it's interesting. I haven't heard a lot of Indian commentary in the current context. I don't know if they're trying to just let Musharraf hang himself, or if they don't want to be viewed as sort of, you know, irresponsibly stirring up the situation.
Yeah, right. I guess virtually anything they'd say would be interpreted as stirring up the situation and causing problems.
But my guess is if pushed, they would say, well, you know, at least if, you know, whatever happens there, at least we have a deterrent. You know, they would probably, I would guess, at least at the governmental level, use it as an argument for why they were, this was a wise direction for them to take.
I mean, I wonder if that's sort of the thinking. I mean, I suspect that's what our thinking would be as well, right? I mean, both with the, you know, I mean, sort of, you know, sort of on both sides of the aisle, that this is one of the reasons why it's a good thing for the Indians to have, you know, for the Indians to have a nuclear arsenal as, you know, as deterrence. So this is.
Well, I'd like to see it rolled back, but there's probably a.
You'd like to see the entire
number.
Indian program rolled back?
Well, it'd have to be regionally done, you know, with Pakistan.
Right.
So obviously that's not in the cards in the short term. It's too much of an immediate problem on the on our hands. But, you know, I think it's always dangerous to figure out what that level of deterrence is, depending who's in government in Pakistan, depending what levels they reach, depending whether China and India continue to have good relationships. And, of course, depending how secure these things are, if an extremist group tries to get hold of them in a place like Pakistan where they're interpenetrated with the security services and the military, you know, I think my long-term belief is we should be trying to reduce these things, not viewing them as a positive in the region. But, you know, I think in the short term that's kind of off the table because the, you know, the leadership crisis in Pakistan is issue number one, and any short-term things about what's known or can be done about the security of their existing arsenal, you know, is probably much more important than any kind of long-term discussion of the, you know, the size of it or what happens vis-a-vis India later.
This is sort of on a different subject, though. Though, if you want, I mean, I'd be interested in coming back to also sort of proliferation throughout the, you know, throughout the Middle East. I mean, if the Iranians do. You know, I mean, what, basically, what are our ideas? I mean, if the Iranians do, you know, do get a nuclear program, or if they complete their, you know, complete their nuclear program, then what do we do with? There was an item I think I came across the other day where now I think the Egyptians and the Saudis are talking about going into a joint project to enrich uranium. I mean, what do we do as far as proliferation in a very unstable, volatile, and strategically vital region like the Middle East? How do we think about this now?
Yeah, and I think it's sort of in stages. I mean, first, if we could head off Iran at the stage where it had an enrichment capability, but it was heavily monitored, inspected, had agreed that they would not build a weapon, I think that would be an important breakpoint. If that couldn't be accomplished and they were to proceed and actually get a nuclear weapon, or it was assumed they had one in that kind of netherland that North Korea was in for a few years, then I think other countries, the Saudis and others, are going to say, well, gee, maybe we need this, at least the capability, which means we need enrichment. And then it'll be that same debate of, well, how far will they enrich and how do we know when they're at the point when they can build a weapon? And so one argument that's been made is, well, you know, there should be sort of a third party that provides fuel, nuclear fuel, and that the enrichment is not controlled by individual countries. But that doesn't really deal with the security problem. It deals with the, if they're saying they need it for energy, then you could argue, well, here's a way to get energy that limits the proliferation risk. But if they're saying, you know, explicitly or not, then it's really because we're afraid of nuclear weapons, they're not going to give up enrichment. I mean, that's sort of the whole point of pursuing the nuclear path. So I think at some point, if the Iranian program can't be stopped, there's got to be some sort of regional discussions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're really up against it because, of course, then the question of Israel's arsenal comes on the table.
Right.
And although they're not supposed to say it, everybody knows they have, you know, at least 100 or 200 of these things.
Well, I believe that Olmert...
So I think it puts more urgency on really vigorous diplomacy with Iran. And I think we do have maybe a 5 to 10 year window. I mean, we need to show progress before then, but it doesn't have to happen tomorrow. although it is a bit like the futures market, what people think Iran might be doing will affect what countries like Egypt might start doing now. So.
Right. I mean, do we start putting these you know, these allies under our nuclear umbrella, or what happens? And what, you know, I mean, you know, everyone from the Saudis to from the Saudis to Egypt, Jordan, Turkey. I mean, it's a huge issue.
Now, how do you see it? What do you think is the best way forward in this nightmare in the Middle East?
I think the best thing is to try to stop the Iranian program, not to try to, but definitely to stop the program, because the idea of proliferation in the Middle East is just I can't imagine a scarier thing. And of course, I mean, you know this. This is your subject, so I'm curious to know from you. But I mean, my sense is what if you have two or three of these things. The point is, you want to use them, right? I mean, it's not that you want to use them, but that deterrence doesn't work as well if you don't have as large an arsenal, correct? So what happens if you have a limited arsenal in Egypt, a limited arsenal in the UAE, a limited arsenal in Algeria? I mean, all of these states, we look at all these states, they're all fighting each other in different ways. The Egyptians and the Saudis, there are hundreds of years of enmity there. So it's not just about Shia and Sunni or the Iranians and the Iranians and the Arabs. There's all these different states, and Israel is just one part of an enormous problem throughout the region. So I can't imagine a more daunting scenario than proliferation throughout the Middle East.
Well, deterrence in that context is something that hasn't really been tried. I mean, you know, in the U.S.-Soviet context, I think it took quite a while before there was sort of communications and proper understandings on each side of what could be done short of war, and to make sure that there wasn't a mistaken conflict. Right. And all that was really had to be learned on the fly because these weapons were unprecedented.
Right.
So there's that experience exists, but not so much in terms of a multi-sided conflict. And so if you're looking at the one hand, you know, if the Saudis are thinking about Iran, they're thinking about Israel, the Algerians, the Moroccans, the sub-state groups.
Yeah, exactly. Another problem.
Then, you know, small arsenals, you know, may not be that stabilizing because who are you deterring against? I mean, how do you know how much is enough when you don't know who has...
Right.
Who has what capabilities, and I think at that point it becomes so complicated that I would agree that it's got to be heading it off is our best possible hope. But we would probably differ on the means. I mean, I really think I don't see a military option vis-a-vis Iran. Yeah. I don't know if you've thought about that, but I sort of see it as disciplined diplomacy is unfortunately or fortunately our best option. This current situation.
Mm-hmm. I do believe that everyone would prefer a diplomatic solution. Though I definitely think that pretty much by all means that the Iranian nuclear program has to be stopped. I mean, one of the things that actually that Pakistan has sort of put into relief is the amount of intellectual energy and anxiety over the Iranian nuclear program. It's a very big deal. But I was in Lebanon for a couple of years, and it's understandable when the Lebanese talk about it in terms of a U.S.-Iranian Cold War over the Middle East. It makes sense the Lebanese would look at it like this. But the way that American strategists and policymakers are talking about what is effectively a U.S.-Iran Cold War, you want to say, please. The U.S. was at war with the Soviet Union for almost five decades on several continents. This is an Islamist regime. You know, it is a third world Islamist regime. And I think that in some ways, Pakistan has put this into relief to say that, yes, of course, Iran is a big deal. Iran is fighting the U.S. in Iraq, in Lebanon, in the Gulf, all over the place. But, you know, is it that difficult to solve this problem?
Well, I think, and also as difficult as it would be, Iran getting a nuclear weapon, it wouldn't be a threat to the future existence of the United States, which in the early days of the Cold War, that was what was at issue. Now that's that's got its downsides, which is that it may not garner the attention it should because it's not an existential threat, and therefore the possibility of these weapons being used at a regional level probably increases from what it was during the Cold War. So it's a very difficult set of calculations to make of how to factor that into the whole range of foreign policy concerns that you have, which is why, not to beat a dead horse, but preventing it is such a preferable option to having to deal with that.
Why do you think that we won't talk more explicitly? I mean, the most public conversation, certainly concerning the Iranian program, is about Israel. Why do you think that we seem so reluctant to talk publicly about our, about our hegemony over the Persian Gulf, which is a vital U.S. interest? This is a very big deal. I mean, it is something that people will nod to and that people acknowledge, but why do you think there is not more of a public case made for saying it is the affordable flow or the flow of affordable Persian Gulf oil is a vital U.S. interest to ensure, the stability of global markets? It's a big deal. We intend to protect our stake in the Persian Gulf, come what may. Why do you think that there is so that it's something we just don't talk about all that much in this country?
I mean, it's funny. When you were saying that, I was thinking of Jimmy Carter.
Because Carter was the one who talked about
his doctrine.
And the Carter Doctrine,
Was more explicit in that regard than anything since. And it was as rationale for building a rapid deployment force, which became the U.S. Central Command, which really it was kind of a, the notion that there's always been kind of a big, or is a big Democratic-Republican divide, and this is not always borne out if you look at the...
That's a very good point. You're right. It's the Carter Doctrine, the rapid deployment force.
But I think now it's very episodic. There'll be sort of a mention of oil interests, but it's often confused in the public mind as if, it would be saying, well, we're going there for the oil companies, which certainly is not the issue. The issue is, as a strategic resource, who's going to control it, and is it going to be in unfriendly hands and so forth. And so I think there's a reluctance to do that because it runs contrary to some of the more soaring rhetoric about democracy and American values and so forth. It might be refreshing almost if there was a debate across the spectrum saying, well, let's assume this is the primary interest.
You remember when Alan Greenspan said that. I mean, in his new book, there's something about that. And this was in the news about a month ago where Greenspan said, yeah, of course, oil has a big deal to do with it. And, Secretary Gates said, I wasn't here when these decisions were made, but I just don't believe it. Please, there's nothing wrong with it. Greenspan was exactly correct.
I mean, I think that there's the same objectives could be achieved without, I don't think the means for achieving oil security for the West or for the industrialized democracies, however you want to look at it, requires our current policies necessarily. Mm-hmm. But if it was on the table that this is A or the primary interest, I think you could have a much more interesting debate about how to how to secure those objectives than we've had currently, because it's really about democracy. And if you look at Iraq at the moment, democracy is a very distant prospect. So it becomes sort of a very abstract discussion, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask you about, as I said before, I'm speaking here from the Hudson Institute, which is certainly not, it's a neoconservative outfit, but not as much as AEI. But I write a lot for the Weekly Standard, and that, of course, is, insofar as democracy promotion is a very big deal in the neoconservative agenda. Just to look at Pakistan specifically for a moment, what's your sense of the freedom agenda and democracy promotion, and what's going to happen after the Bush administration? What's the tally, especially now looking at Pakistan? Has democracy promotion worked? How should we continue to support it? What's your sense?
Yeah, well, I've always been a little hesitant about the term, partly because of the way it was used in Iraq, in the sense that it was used in the context of a rationale for military force. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's a lot of different ways to promote democracy, and I would say trying to do it by force is probably the least advisable and the most likely to lead you to huge problems of the sorts that we're now seeing. But there's a whole other range of tools, you know, how you use your military aid, how you use your economic aid, should you fund civil society groups that get training in, you know, independent judiciary techniques, mm-hmm. and independent media mm-hmm. activities and so forth that are, you know, as happened in places like the Ukraine, you know, or sort of what's your democracy promotion toolbox, and then what priority do you give democracy promotion amongst your other security interests? And so mm-hmm. I think there's got to be some sort of, I guess you call it soft democracy promotion agenda mm-hmm. that includes outreach to civil society groups and helping support human rights activists and at least pressuring countries to have some more open political system that allows for people to make their views heard, to vote for meaningful, meaningful differences, not just sort of controlled mm-hmm. system like you have in Iran, for example. So the thing there is, well, how far do you go? And given that that's much more difficult to achieve, that kind of soft power, leverage, how much time is it worth? And I think mm-hmm. in a case like Pakistan, where you're at this turning point, it's worth a fair amount of focus, and mm-hmm. then ideally getting ahead of the game so that you don't only sort of wield these tools when it's, 5 minutes to midnight, so to speak.
Right. I guess this is a very good point. I think this is actually kind of the central point. If you want to talk about, I was in the region for a lot of the time, and I saw elections in Egypt, I saw elections in Lebanon, and elections are very exciting, but this is certainly not, this is not the heart of, this should not be the heart of democracy promotion, and I guess there has to be a lot of work done. And I guess my question is, does the United States even have the amount of, do we have the amount of manpower in our political policy-making institutions, whether it's the State Department, whether it's the National Security Council, the Pentagon, to keep the amount of attention and pressure we need on places like Pakistan, on Egypt? Do you know what I mean? If we can't just turn our attention when things get bad or when we say we want elections, but to stay on top of these various regimes, to stay on top of these various governments, saying, no, this is what we want from you. We want this amount of political room for this group of lawyers. We're checking on the judiciary, freedom of expression issues, freedom of the press. How much energy and how much manpower do we have to do the real hard work of democracy promotion? If you look at how much we're trying, in lots of ways, I think it's been a fantastic and idealistic and really a really wonderful idea. The rhetoric seems to me all correct, but what do we actually do?
I think the resources really aren't there, unfortunately. There's not even enough. There's not enough people with language specialties. There's not enough people with specialties in the regions and the areas that we need to track. The State Department Human Rights Report is a lot less detailed than it used to be to even give you sort of, big level indicators of whether countries are moving in the right direction. There's been, I'd say, friction, between this administration, some of the NGOs that follow this stuff, they've gotten into political battles and not as much working together on documenting what's happening in the field in all these countries. So I think it would require a shift of resources and focus, which I think the money is available, but it's a lot harder sell because it's not, there's nothing concrete to point to on a month-by-month or year-by-year basis to say, see, because we have these people here, Egypt didn't explode. You can't really prove that.
I agree with you entirely, and I might even be, I think I'm more pessimistic, because my sense is that these regimes, Musharraf. This guy is fighting for his political life right now. It is basically the only thing in the world that matters to him. And if we look at regimes around the region, what matters to them is staying in power. And if we're looking at however many people we can throw at Egypt, however many people we can throw at Saudi Arabia, however many people we can throw at Pakistan, we're still dealing with the fact that these guys, for them, it's a life and death issue. You know, for us, it's something that we want. It just seems that in some way they're bound to win this. They're bound to win this fight, and democracy promotion is going to be very, very hard for us.
Oh, I think it is. It definitely is. But I think the issue is, should we get serious about it and make it a long-term commitment, or is it going to be used kind of intermittently and opportunistically, depending on the nature of the government in question and the particular policies of our administration at the moment. I think it really hasn't been given any kind of serious try as a policy that's explicitly debated, that's not just brought in at the last minute as it was in the war in Iraq. It wasn't like that was the initial pitch for the war. Was, well, you know, if we can create a democracy in Iraq, it's going to have positive ripple effects. It was all about the rapidly disappearing weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
So, I'm uncomfortable in this terrain because I think a lot of my professional and personal interest has always been sort of with the do no harm approach. You know, don't arm this dictator and don't side with the wrong. But that doesn't really, when you're as big a power as the United States, that's not a sufficient approach to the world, because doing or not doing something is in itself has huge repercussions. You know, so you can't just say, well, our hands are clean now, we'll just see what happens. And I think Pakistan is sort of one of the best examples of that.
Well, is this going to be, and maybe we should finish off pretty soon. I guess we're getting close to the end of our time. But I guess if you have a parting question for me, but I'll leave with a parting question for you, and maybe you'll make me answer the same question. But will Pakistan sort of wind up being the coda to the Bush administration's democratization project for the Muslim Middle East? That as much as we'd like to see these things turn around, that as much as we would like a place like Pakistan to be different, we have so many different issues there, from terrorism to nuclear weapons, that democracy agenda has really sort of, at least for the time being, been rolled back. So I guess that would be my parting question.
Well, yeah, I think as the in the neoconservative sense of democracy promotion, which I think had a great urgency to it. You know, it's going to happen now. It's going to happen on our watch. We're going to see real results. We're going to use force if necessary. We'll use other tools as needed. I think that is probably by the boards for quite a long while. On the other hand, since Pakistan and Iraq are such different cases, in Iraq, there really wasn't, to my mind, an immediate strategic threat that had to be dealt with. So if you were going to make a democracy promotion case, you were going to basically say, even if there's no short-term security threat, we have other interests in promoting democracy, and those interests are so urgent that we have to do it now, even if it means by force. And I think that'll always be a hard case to make in the wake of Iraq. But if you're looking to the longer term and saying, had we been promoting democracy through these non-military tools further along, holding our allies to higher standards, supporting NGOs and other sort of incubators of democratic practice, might we head off this kind of terrible situation we've been forced into in Pakistan, for example, then I think there's a rationale for some version of a democracy promotion policy, but it'll suffer from the fact that you don't have kind of some big red light or big explosion that you can point to people and say, you know, this is why this is urgent now, as opposed to this is something that's got to be kind of like doing your exercises, some sort of ongoing necessary activity that'll have positive results, but not necessarily ones that are going to be grist for News at 11 kind of thing. So I don't know. Yeah, from your point of view, I'd be interested both sort of where you see the democracy promotion agenda or policies. Is it dead in the water, and how does it fit with other practical concerns? And also, in the case of Musharraf himself, what kind of options do we have in these next 6 months even to deal with the situation there? Is there a good policy that you would see, or we basically have our hands tied?
I think, just to answer astonishingly what I think is the easier question first, Maybe it's just the, I don't see another option right now than to support Musharraf. And I see a number of different reasons for that. I think we should not be sending this message to allies in the war on terror that, none of these guys, they're all fighting half-heartedly. The Egyptians are fighting half-heartedly. The Saudis are fighting half-heartedly. None of these guys are really fighting as hard as we need them to be fighting. And so Musharraf is no different from the rest of them. But I think to turn our backs on Musharraf at this point sends a very dangerous message to our lukewarm allies in the region, which I don't think that we can afford to send right now. I would like to see us pursuing other things at the same time. I would like to see if it's possible. Musharraf is, was this today that Musharraf, I guess, is called for, called for elections in January. If there's still some, I still basically think that Musharraf is, we can't turn our back on him now. As far as the democracy promotion, the freedom agenda goes generally, yeah, I agree with you. This is something that's going to take an awful long time. It's not something that's going to turn around immediately. And I think that this is one of the enormous issues that, one of the enormous gulfs that exists between us and, the Muslim Middle East, the Arab world, that we're just working on different time schedules. These are very old places with very old societies and old cultures, and it takes a long time for things to change. People just have a different sense of time. For instance, in Lebanon, a comparison I often make is, Lebanese Christians, they point to the fact that, Lebanon is in the Bible, both the Old and New Testament. Lebanon is not going anywhere. They're not going to leave. But that sort of time frame should give us a sense of how long, not necessarily 2,000 years, but just our time frame is different. We're working in different time cycles. I think until we get to that stage, until we recognize that it's going to take quite a while, it's not going to turn around during the course of our election cycles, we're going to be beating our heads against the wall in terms of democracy promotion. I'm curious to know. It seems that the Giuliani campaign has pushed this, pretty far to the back of their agenda. Who's talking about it right now? Who's talking about it right now among the 2008 candidates? Democracy promotion has taken kind of a hit. And if it's something that has to be revived in 4 years or 8 years, if it's something we have to keep reviving every once in a while, it's going to be a big, it's going to be a big problem. For the time being, I totally agree. And so far as it's something that that a lot of us thought was going to happen quickly, and there were things that I saw when I was in different places, this is exciting and breathtaking and galvanizing. It's going to take a while. So I agree.
Well, I guess we're not supposed to agree too much, but
well, we can argue some other time, and it's a nice way to end the discussion.
No, I think it was. I enjoyed it a lot. It made me think. Possible in any form.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much. Yeah. All right, Bill. We'll take care. I hope we get to meet sometime in Washington.
Oh, that'd be great.
All right, I'll send you an email then.
Okay, good. Take care.
All right, Bill. Bye-bye.
Bye.